Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin. Something a little bit different for this show today. Back in early October, your weekly host was invited to Georgetown University as part of an esteemed panel discussion about religious liberty, democracy, and social flourishing sponsored by the Religious Freedom Project at the Berkeley Center for Religion, Peace, and World Affairs. The discussion was so good that we decided to release it here on Research on Religion. The panel discussion is moderated by Timothy Shaw, a former guest on this program, and includes, in order of appearance, Dan Philpott, Nuket Sandal, Ani Sarkissian, and yours truly, Tony Gill. Dan and Ani were also recent guests on our podcast and will provide links to their interviews as well as other related ones over at our website. Please visit. We will be featuring another one of the panels at this symposium related to religious liberty and economic growth in the coming week, so please stay tuned and don't forget to visit us on Facebook. And without any further ado, on with the show.
People who are still in this room must really, really like religious freedom. So you're all going to get a special prize for staying here to the very end of our two-day conference on freedom to flourish. Is religious freedom necessary for peace, prosperity, and democracy? And you all must be wondering, is religious freedom really that necessary for my flourishing, that I should stay here for 2 days? But I'm very grateful that you have. I hope that it has been good for your flourishing individually. We are delighted that we have to close out our conference outstanding experts on religious freedom, particularly experts on the relationship between religious freedom and democracy. So the topic of our panel, our final panel, is what is the evidence that religious freedom is necessary for the political success of free societies? Those of you who were part of our day-long discussion yesterday will know that in a sense, the relationship between religious freedom and democracy really was the subject of our discussion yesterday. But the subject yesterday was discussed in a largely philosophical manner, in a theoretical manner, from the point of view of normative political theory and moral philosophy. This panel will be focused on the relationship between religious freedom and democracy from an empirical point of view. In other words, what is the empirical record, the empirical relationship between actual levels of religious freedom in the real world and actual levels of democracy? In other words, what are the correlations as well as the causal connections between different levels of religious freedom and different levels of democracy? And to discuss these questions, we honestly, I don't flatter this panel, we could not have a more impressive, varied set of experts. And what I'm going to do is introduce the panel quickly, all four of the panelists, and then we will proceed in order from Dan Philpott onward, and then we'll finish with Tony Gill, who I think I don't mean this in any way to insult the other panelists, but Tony Gill, in a lot of ways, is the intellectual pioneer in terms of the study of religious freedom in political science. Has written an outstanding book, The Political Origins of Religious Liberty. And I can honestly say that without Tony, not. Without Tony, we would really not even be able to have this conversation in a fruitful and productive way. So thank you, Tony, for enabling us, paving the way intellectually, for enabling us to have such a fruitful conversation about the relationship between religious freedom and political democratization and political freedom. But we'll get to Tony later. Let me first introduce Daniel Philpott. Daniel Philpott has for the last 3 years been a formally affiliated scholar with the Religious Freedom Project. He is professor in the Department of Political Science and the Joan B. Kroc Institute for Peace Studies at the University of Notre Dame. Dan is the author of a number of very impressive books, the author of Revolutions and Sovereignty, How Ideas Shaped Modern International Relations, most recently, Just and Unjust Peace, A Political Ethic of Reconciliation, and also God's Century, a book Dan and I happened to write together with Monica Toft. Dan has written numerous articles on religion, sovereignty, international affairs, religious freedom and foreign policy, the ethics of self-determination. Right now, Dan, for the Religious Freedom Project, is working on a book on Islam and religious freedom. And then after we hear from Dan, we will hear from Nuket Sandal, whom I encountered at Boston University for the first time. It must have been at least 6 or 7 years ago, maybe more, Nuket. Nuket has gone on to become one of the most exciting emerging scholars of the relationship between religion and international relations. She is a co-author with Jonathan Fox of a book that is really a comprehensive guide to the relationship between religion and international relations theory, which will be published later this year. Is that right?
It has already been published.
Already been published. Okay, well, congratulations. She is an assistant professor of political science at Ohio University, where she, again, researches and teaches religion and international affairs. She formerly taught at Brown. She's published articles in all kinds of journals, the European Journal of International Relations, Review of International Studies, Political Studies, Human Rights Quarterly, and the Canadian Journal of Political Science. She has her PhD from the University of Southern California. Great to have you, Nuket.
Thank you.
And then after Nuket, we will hear from Ani Sarkissian. Ani Sarkissian is an assistant professor of political science at Michigan State University, where she is a core faculty member of the Muslim Studies Program and the Center for European, Russian, and European Studies. Her research agenda focuses on religion in politics. She does comparative work on the relationship between religion and politics around the world. She's currently completing a book manuscript for Oxford University Press, and I've had the privilege of actually seeing some of the draft chapters of Ani Sarkissian's book, which is entitled The Varieties of Religious Repression. It will be a landmark book, which examines how and why authoritarian regimes use religious restrictions as an instrument of their political rule. She is also involved in a project investigating the political consequences of the Roman Catholic Charismatic Renewal in sub-Saharan Africa, which is sponsored by the Pentecostal Charismatic Research Initiative made possible by the John Templeton Foundation. And then finally, but as I said, last but very much not least, is Tony Gill. Tony is a professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Washington, adjunct professor of sociology at the University of Washington, and a distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for the Studies of Religion. The director of that institute, Byron Johnson, spent much of the last 2 days here at the conference, but had to leave early. Tony specializes in political economy and religion and politics, with an emphasis on church-state relations, religious liberty, and religious economies. He's the author of major books, Rendering Unto Caesar, the Catholic Church and the State in Latin America, which had a major impact when it came out in the late 1990s. And as I mentioned earlier, he's also the author of The Political Origins of Religious Liberty, Cambridge University Press, 2007. And I should add, he'll be happy for me to mention that his latest endeavor is a weekly podcast series on religion that seeks to make social scientific studies of religion available to the common man. And it's also free. And you can hear a number of the people actually on this panel as part of your podcast series. Ani is on the podcast series. Dan Philpott, Rebecca Shaw has been on the podcast series. So check it out. What's the website for that?
It's called Research on Religion. I have some brochures up here. It's not only available for the common man, but also for women as well. I don't want to get in trouble back there.
Okay, very good.
So brochures up here if you want.
Right. It's not a patriarchal institution. So, as I mentioned earlier, we are going to, in this panel, explore the empirical relationships between levels of religious freedom and levels of democracy. So I'm going to invite each of our panelists to say a few minutes about what is the empirical record in terms of the relationship between, first, the suppression of religious freedom and lower levels of democracy, but also what is the relationship between higher levels of religious freedom and higher levels of democracy? The panelists can approach those questions however they wish. They've already prepared very interesting praises of their remarks. So we'll start with Dan Philpott.
Well, thank you very much, Tim. So I want to begin with the first question that we were posed. Is religious freedom essential to the success of free government? It is possible to have liberal democracy in most respects, but without religious freedom. But such regimes are less liberal for their lack of religious freedom. I have in mind the French Third Republic or Germany under Bismarck, which expanded the suffrage and other dimensions of democracy even while they managed or repressed religion. Today, Indonesia has made impressive strides towards democracy since the fall of the Suharto regime, but has laws that restrict religious freedom significantly. In such cases, the quality of democracy suffers not only intrinsically, but also because these arrangements tend to suppress the positive contribution that to freedom that religion might make. Conversely, religious repression sustains authoritarian governments. The pathway of repression takes at least two forms. First, authoritarian governments straightforwardly establish and maintain their rule by suppressing religious organizations and communities that serve as a threat to their rule. One thinks of the Republic of Turkey prior to 2002, whose military and judiciary combined to intervene to prevent the rule of Islamic parties, even when they had achieved victory in elections, or numerous post-World War II Arab dictatorships, which repressed Islamic groups that opposed what they saw as the secularism of their regimes. A second form is what might be thought of as the circle of repression. Governments repress religion, religion strikes back, and governments repress even more. A common pattern in the Arab dictatorships is that they sought to control Islam sharply by establishing and upholding a moderate form of Islam as official, and then suppressing more conservative forms of Islam. The result was a radicalization of the conservative groups and often a turn to violence, at least among some of their members. In response, the governments would repress further. Religious freedom instantiates and strengthens liberal democracy and its freedoms through the kinds of activities that it allows. Several of these activities overlap with other freedoms and civil rights. Religious freedom unleashes religious organizations and leaders to engage in democratic debate, free speech, to gather both for worship and for political advocacy, assembly, to engage in political processes through lobbying, elections, and sometimes even forming a political party, as with Christian democracy, political participation, and to promote civil society through schools, universities, hospitals, homes for the elderly, orphanages, and other sectors of society that exist apart from and serve as a check upon state power. Religious freedom also empowers religions to promote cultural and ideational influences that support democracy. Because most religions stress the prime importance of God, gods, or powers that transcend human affairs, and consider these transcendent powers to be worthy of veneration and worship, and in some sense ultimate, they are more likely to stress the limited authority of government and to resist the totalitarian impulse. Because religions see a special role for a clerical caste or vocation, they have reason to protect clerics' proper vocation and role from the consuming tendencies of the state, and sometimes also to insist that clerics themselves do not hold political office. Thus, we get duality of authority and separation of religion and state, key features of liberal democracy. It will be objected that not all religious groups will manifest these pro-liberal democratic tendencies. Indeed, they don't. Much depends on their political theology. Should illiberal ones then be suppressed? The impulse should be resisted as much as possible, for giving religious groups freedom to operate is likely to make them friendlier to democratic processes than they otherwise would be. They are less likely to be radicalized by resentment, they will have to build coalitions, which tends to be moderating, and they will have to argue, which allows others to challenge their beliefs and requires them to defend their beliefs more carefully. It should also be pointed out that the internal resources of religious groups for promoting democracy, or at least features of it, are wider than one might think. Islam, for instance, is often described as lacking a tradition of separation of religion and state. But in fact, just such a separation between clerics and political rulers has been strongly endorsed through much of Islam's history. In medieval Islam, for instance, one can find a marked tradition of separation. Not the separation envisioned by Thomas Jefferson, no doubt, but not at all fusionist either. The independence to operate of religious groups can help to defeat authoritarian regimes. This independence may not be full religious freedom of the kind that is guaranteed by law. After all, we are talking about authoritarian regimes. But when religious groups enjoy de facto independence under authoritarian regimes, what my co-authors Taft, Shah, and I have called conflictual independence, and when they are inclined to oppose these regimes, they can be powerful forces for democratization. Numerous examples come to mind, ranging from the Catholic Church in Poland, Chile, the Philippines, Malawi, and South Africa, to the dissident pastors in the German Protestant Church, to the Nahdlatul Ulama and Muhammadiyah parties in Indonesia. They help to promote these transitions through protest, through behind-the-scenes negotiations with authoritarian leaders, and through mediating peace agreements that end civil war and yield transitions to democracy. Scholars like Adrian Karatnicki of Freedom House and the team of political scientists Mariah Stefan and Erica Chenoweth have offered powerful evidence of the prevalence and power of nonviolent movements in eliciting transitions to democratic rule. I used to think that the nonviolent movements of the world were just the occasional Gandhis and Martin Luther Kings, that it only worked under certain very specified conditions and so forth. But I think they've shown otherwise, that these are part and parcel of global politics. Some 67 people power movements have toppled dictatorships in the past generation or so, nonviolent ones. Religious groups have played a role in a strikingly large number of these movements. In some 48 out of 78 democratizations, Shah and I report in God's Century, religious movements played a significant role. In cases like those listed above, this role was more than significant, but rather pivotal and powerful. What implications does this analysis have for American foreign policy? Consider Egypt and Syria, both of which have elicited an inordinate amount of the U.S. government's attention lately. In both countries, religious freedom is threatened from two sides, from Islamist movements and from repressive secular governments. Egypt has oscillated from Mubarak's government, which jailed thousands of Muslim dissidents, to an Islamist-leaning government under which a hemorrhage of Coptic Christians took place, back to a military government that has already cracked down not only on religious violence, but also on religious organizations and religious authorities. Syria has been ruled by the brutal dictatorship of Assad and father for decades, which practiced the Arab model of sharply repressing and managing Islam. In response, the Syrian armed opposition is increasingly made up of Islamist factions, destined to impose a harsh form of Sharia law should they succeed. Can these countries ever reach stability? Liberal Democrats, whether secular and friendly to religious freedom or religious and friendly to democracy, are all too small and weak in both cases. Still, in a long-term sense, religious freedom is a promising solution. To call it a solution must be stated advisedly, for I don't expect either country to practice robust religious freedom anytime soon. Still, there are reasons why religious freedom is what these countries need if they are ever to achieve stability. Majority Islamic groups need to be convinced that they can participate in shaping the country's system according to their values, and that they won't be repressed or jailed simply on account of the culture that they advocate. In return, they must agree to allow people of other faiths or other versions of Islam full freedom to worship, organize, and express their faith, and to respect other fundamental human rights, like the rights of women, for instance. On the other hand, secularists have to agree that stability requires that they not try to manage religion or to impose their secularism as the country's future. They must come to allow that religious groups can participate in democracy without ipso facto threatening to undermine democracy. But they also have the right to demand that the country be governed by liberal democratic norms. To state this is not at all to say that the solution will come anytime soon. but neither did it come about quickly or straightforwardly in the West. But it is the solution that is needed both to achieve democratic stability in such settings and to give the U.S. a stable ally. What can the U.S. do? Its ability to control these countries' destiny is limited. Still, much could be achieved by adopting religious freedom as a rhetorical, policy, strategic, and diplomatic tool and goal, one that comes to be front and center in the statements and actions of the U.S. government. That would require getting religious freedom off its foggy bottom and into the White House. Thank you.
Very, very good, Dan Philpott. Did you hear that, State Department? Get off your foggy bottom. All right. Nuket.
Okay, that is the fate of my life. Whatever good idea I have come up with in my life, I always discover that Dan Philpott has written about it, so I have to change my project. Now I'm going after Dan Philpott, so this is kind of frustrating. But I'll do my best. So
you're going to do great. Yeah, don't worry.
Going after? In what sense? No.
I mean, both senses, yeah. I guess. I don't know. So I would like to talk a bit about my own questions in my academic life and how I started to focus on religion, democratization, and human rights. My dissertation project, I'm a Turkish woman, and my dissertation project was a product of reverse Orientalism. I did my research in Northern Ireland. So, which was amazing because I got to secure some interviews that my Catholic and Protestant colleagues could not, because many of the UVF and PIRA paramilitaries were totally okay with talking to a Muslim woman because they will not be judged. So it was a great experience. At the same time, I'm coming from a very neutral background because obviously I'm an outsider. But all these questions that we talked about Islam today occurred to me as it relates to Christianity. So as I was talking to different people, how they interpreted Catholicism or the Protestant tradition obviously differed a lot. And every single day I was seeing another interpretation of it. I mean, to give a very simple example, those of you who have worked on Northern Ireland would know this example. Sean McStoffane, who was the chief of staff of Provisional Irish Republican Army between 1969 and 1972, was a very devout Catholic to the extent that he banned the use of condoms in making explosives. So, would you call this Catholicism? I mean, it was when I found out about this, I checked this on like different sources because I thought it was a joke first, and then it was a legend apparently that he was. I mean, obviously, this is not how you picture Catholicism in your mind, because I have this picture of right Catholicism that I have been interacting with these amazing people who are all for peace, Catholicism and peace building, and then you see this. So at that point, and I knew that I would come back to my roots or region, and I thought, well, different lines of Catholicism, how they define their belief, how they define citizenship. So why don't I look at the Middle East from the same lens, keeping in mind this distinction between bad religion and good religion, which in my work I call public theologies. So what we are talking about is not really religion, but different public theologies of citizenship, of health, of peace building. So in Islam, there are conflicting public theologies in Catholicism, in Protestant tradition, in every religion, what is acceptable to do in a public sphere. So my particular work is focusing on public theologies of citizenship in the Middle East, and particularly I'm interested in how minorities, non-Muslim minorities, are portrayed and are constructed in the political systems of these countries. I'm particularly interested in Egypt, Syria, Lebanon, and Turkey. Mm. I will give you some snapshots from my Turkey case because I have conducted more than 100 interviews in the past 3 years, ranging from Istanbul to mountains in the east. So I just want to share some examples that surprised me as a Turkish citizen and I thought worth sharing. So first of all, when we talk about Turkey, we always assume that it's a secular country. Everybody says that. Turkey is not really a secular country when it comes to its dealings with the minorities. Until very recently, Armenian, Greek Orthodox, and Jewish communities were represented by their religious leaders, not by their secular community leaders. And obviously, there are other examples on our ID cards. Our religions are written. My blood group is not written on my ID card. So if I have an accident, they don't know how to save me. But if I die, they know where to bury me. I always say that. So there is this pro-Sunni bias in the construction of citizenship in Turkey. Bernard Lewis once said that you can imagine a Christian Arab, but you cannot imagine a Christian Turk. Well, because this is how the citizenship was constructed in 1920s, 1930s. So we are talking about legislation here, how you legislate religious freedoms and everything. Sometimes legislation is overrated, because even if you legislate it, unless you change the public theology in a country, it is really difficult to address the real problems we are facing right now. One other example, the Christian churches, on paper, in Turkey, you can establish a Christian church, a Protestant church.
You can.
But in practice, the representatives of the Protestant churches I talked to said that they were required to secure the approvals of neighboring shops before they opened that church. Everybody had to sign a paper that said that they were totally okay with that church. Even worse, in 1991, if you wanted to open a Protestant church, you needed to go to terrorism department in Turkey in order to secure approval. In time, this changed. Like, it was minority and associations department, and right now it is it's different. So in order to keep it short, I will touch upon an important concept, and then I will leave the rest for question and answer. Everybody is talking about, obviously, first Muslim Brotherhood and then Syria, and now then AK Party government. So what changed under the AK Party government? When I started my research, and I'm coming from a very secular family, I was assuming that, okay, I'll talk to these Jews, these Greeks, these Armenians, and they will tell me how bad the situation is. Well, I mean, so some of my colleagues warned me, and they said that, well, you will not quite have the desired answer. And yes, I mean, I didn't. So everybody was like, well, we actually feel more secure under AK Party government. I was really surprised, but for the first time, the minorities have a secular representative that is directly connected to the prime minister. Mm. For the first time, some of the lands that belong to these churches but were confiscated by the Turkish state, they are gradually being given back. So we are talking about increasing religious freedoms of Jews, of the Greek Rum community, and the Armenian community to an extent. And I can also say that the Armenian civil society is much more visible when compared to 20, 30 years ago. But at the same time, can you call AK Party government a democratic government, given that Turkey has more journalists in jail than in Iran or in China? So this is a mixed bag, and this is a great example of a mixed bag. Why is this government so friendly to these religious minorities, and obviously not democratic by any sense? Right now, actually, very recently, they passed this... now they can detain people who are suspected as protesters. You don't need to protest. If you plan to protest, the Turkish government can see it and can detain you. So we are the matrix of the political world. So it is really creative. But the only way you can explain this is through neo-Ottoman understanding of the political scene. AK Party has been using this religious freedom issue strategically because they want to go back, they want to recreate this neo-Ottoman understanding of human rights. Of course, under us, again, and here I want to take an issue with the word tolerance we have been using all day. Tolerance is the concept of 16th and 17th century. Tolerance is not enough anymore. So we need to see the other person as not someone to be tolerated, but someone who enjoys equal citizenship rights, as we do. So AK Party government uses tolerance, and as long as we are the father, as long as you recognize that we rule you, and as long as you do not really protest your and get out of your comfortable sphere, we will protect your churches and we will protect your synagogues, very much like under Ottoman Empire. You can be responsive to your own leaders. But at the same time, and very similarly, what are the foreign policy implications? AK Party is also, AK Party politicians have been talking about Syria a lot, and they have been reaching out to Africa to create this neo-Ottoman sphere. But they are not okay with dissent. You cannot criticize them. If you criticize them, you will end up in jail. They arrested prominent journalists. They arrested prominent political science professors for whom American Political Science Association had to conduct campaigns. So are we talking about democracy here? No, not at all. If anything, things are going worse. But are we talking about increased religious freedoms for these religious minorities? Yes. We still have here and there things coming up. So the prime minister can always say that, thank God I am not Greek. Or like these things keep cropping up because you cannot get rid of the public theology. But this thing, I don't know. I think this is the biggest danger. The moment you think that things are going great for religious minorities, taking them out of context, thinking that this is democratization by themselves, and then in the future facing something even worse. And the last point I want to make is also how the Christian, religious minorities of the Middle East see each other. That's also an interesting question. When I was talking to Assyrian church representatives, I made the mistake of saying, oh, you know, you have a big Christian presence here. There's a Protestant church right across the street. The representative, who shall remain nameless because the poor people live in Turkey, so anytime anything can happen, he said, no, we are not them. Like, they came later. So we have been in these territories for the past 2,000 years. I'm not going to be the same as that Protestant guy, which was really interesting to me because again, as an outsider, clueless, new academic, I'm like, okay, you Christians. There is no you Christians. Like Greeks, Armenians, and Protestants, they all have different concerns. The Jewish community altogether is, of course, a total different story. So when we are evaluating these, what is the situation with this particular religious minority? We are talking about Copts, we are talking about Assyrians in Syria. It's also important to recognize the particular conditions of that community and their relation, their public theology, when it comes to governance and citizenship, before we carry out any analysis or come up with any conclusions. I'll stop here leave the rest.
Thank you very much. I mean, if I may, it sort of occurred to me that you were describing in Turkey a situation where a very limited religious tolerance is, in a sense, being used to actually reinforce a kind of paternalistic authoritarianism. So in a sense, a very limited religious freedom is actually being used as an instrument of domination.
And the biggest example is if you take the Turkish Istanbul metro right now, the clip is showing like the politicians with the head rabbi, with the Greek Orthodox patriarch, with the Armenian patriarch. So it is used as a strategic instrument.
Mm-hmm. A la the Ottoman Empire of the past. Yeah. Ani Sarkissian.
Thank you. I'd like to touch on, I guess, three main points addressing some of the questions that Tim had posed to us. The first has to do with this question about whether it's possible to have a polity that's liberal and democratic, but that also suppresses religious freedom. And I think that we have to kind of be careful when we're talking about religious freedom and admit that even, and accept that even in democracies, there's various ways that we can construct religious freedom. So whereas in one democracy, religious instruction in schools might be thought of as, in public schools, may be thought of as a restriction or, you know, against religious freedom. In other places, it might be thought of as, you know, necessary for the state to support religious instruction in schools in order to help religion, right, to support religion and encourage it. So I think that's one thing that at least today we haven't touched on as much and as important to bring up. But we also need to be careful in distinguishing between baseline religious freedoms that are sufficient for a country to be considered democratic and additional issues that related to religious freedom that arise once a country begins to kind of consolidate democracy. So these various types of restrictions or freedoms of religion change depending on the context that you're talking about. And so my work has looked both kind of in the democratic, but recently more authoritarian contexts. So it might not be accurate to say that all restrictions on religion equal repression or persecution, but rather we can think about these different kinds of shades of restrictions and what they mean and how they lead to different regime types. But I think we also have to acknowledge that religious repression and persecution are not compatible with democratic governance and do help to foster authoritarianism and to help authoritarian regimes continue and to stay in power. And they're important tools that regimes can use in order to protect their own stability and to protect their own power. I wanted to point to some work that I've done. This isn't a topic that we debate as much, but for a long time we had a lot of work going on in the kind of comparative democratization field on what are the prerequisites for democracy and what do you need to have democracy, and there were always people throwing in religious variables, and so you threw in whether a country was majority this religion or majority that, and Islam was always found to be statistically significant negatively related to democracy, and it was always just Islam is anti-democratic, but not very much done to kind of consider what it was about Islam that was not conducive to democracy. And so I did some work that showed that if you actually factor in the kind of state restrictions on religion, this negative effect of Islam disappears. There's no longer a significant negative relationship between Islam and democracy. And so what we should be looking at not so much is kind of whether a religion is incompatible mm-hmm. with democracy, but rather what states are doing related to religion that's incompatible with democracy. And I think that's really the main point that work showed. And when I looked more specifically at the kinds of restrictions on religion that were most harmful to democracy, I found that they were the ones that related to the freedom of expression, religious expression, and religious association rights. And if we think about these, on the face of it, they don't seem to be directly related to democracy. Okay, you let people proselytize, you let people kind of try to spread their religion or talk about religion or gather together with religion. What does that have to do with democracy? But when you kind of think about it, and if you think about it, especially in the context of religiously divided societies, and that's not only societies that are religiously heterogeneous, but also societies where the question of the relationship between religion and the state and the question and kind of ideas about secularism and religion are highly debated topics. In these places, or in many of these places, religious expression is a very kind of important part of political expression. And so if you are preventing people from organizing based on their religion or speaking out based on their religion, you are, in effect, preventing them from expressing their political viewpoints. And so that's something that I've been trying to develop more in my work, both on a cross-national level, but also looking more specifically at different countries. I've done some work with Turkey on this, but also in other places, about how it is that when you restrict kind of these things that you don't definitely that aren't necessarily political on the face, obviously, how does that actually then get into the political realm? And I think this actually connects to this this idea that E.J. Dionne kind of brought up this morning just in passing about the difference between church-state relations and separation of church and state and separation of religion and politics. So when we talk about state restrictions on religion or state regulation of religion, that's one thing. But there's also this idea that, okay, we can also allow religion and politics to exist, and in this country it happens all the time, but not have the state kind of restricting religion. And something I think that we need to explore more in authoritarian contexts, where I think the two get conflated very often. And so I would argue, that these religious expression and association rights are really the most crucial elements of religious freedom for promoting political freedom and vibrant democracy. And what governments who restrict these things are doing is, in effect, controlling what should be an independent voice in society. And we see this happening in, for instance, Muslim-majority countries, where you see, for example, one of the regions I study is Central Asia, where you have majority Muslim countries, where the restrictions on religion are mostly aimed at Muslims and aimed at politically organized Muslims, because I argue that the leaders of those regimes that are obviously not democratic fear what these groups, you know, the threat that these groups pose to their own legitimacy and the continuation of their own power. So, so by not allowing them to meet in their mosques outside of prayer times or to open mosques independently of the state-controlled religious bureau, what they're trying to do is clamp down on any independent voices arising in society. The final point that I wanted to make had to do with the order. Does religious freedom come before regime transition, or is it a result of transition? And I would argue that you need to have religious freedom first. So, and religious freedom, again, is tied to all of these various other freedoms of expression and association. And I would argue this because if you do have transitions, and we've seen this happening a lot in the world, if you see transitions occurring before freedoms are established and before these kinds of civil societies are allowed to develop, you have these kinds of empty institutions without the personnel to man them, right? So you have these parties that don't represent anything come and go all the time. You have hundreds of parties and some elections in the former Soviet countries that just kind of don't represent much because there isn't kind of much organized at the level of civil society to then kind of, you know, gather together and form these political parties. So so I'd argue that you get kind of these empty institutions without without a kind of strong base to sustain them. So great. I'll stop there.
Thank you. Thank you, Ani, very much. That was outstanding. Well, and last, as I said, but not least, the inestimable Tony Gill. I just want to say, you know, many people have congratulated us on the diversity of our panels. And, you know, we're very proud of the fact that we even have people with cowboy hats who are part of our panels, representing all kinds of cultural groups, ethnic groups, and perspectives. So, Tony, you know, you help us check that box as well. So,
that's right. I represent the redneck American constituency, which oftentimes doesn't get represented here in academia. So.
Welcome to Georgetown, Tony Gill.
Yeah. Yeehaw. All right. When Tim emailed us a while ago, he sent us a list of questions to ask, and I didn't know we had to do an opening statement, so I've been scratching this out. And I didn't know that the title of this thing was about the empirical evidence for this, which means I probably should read my emails closer. So I'm not necessarily going to give you empirical evidence, but I'm going to give you a theoretical argument. And in doing so, I'm going to answer two of the questions that Tim posed to us and that some of my compatriots here have answered here as well. The first question is, can you have a polity that is liberal and democratic in most respects, but that also suppresses religious freedom? Well, my answer is yes. It's called France and Germany and Sweden and increasingly the United States. But on the other hand, I don't know. Maybe some of those things are not all that liberal and democratic. The second question that is asked is, can the promotion of religious liberty lead to sustainable democratic transitions? And my answer is, I hope so, especially in my own country of the United States. And let me go ahead and explain that. And the first question here, which is, can you have a polity that is liberal and democratic in most respects that also suppresses religious freedom? That first question is largely tautological, because if one considers basic individual, and I underline individual, civil liberties and the rule of law to be crucial components of the definition of liberal democracy, then every movement towards religious liberty is a step toward democracy, and every movement away from religious liberty is a step away from liberal democracy. We need to remember that liberal democracy is not just an endpoint, but it's a continuum that rulers and citizens are constantly struggling to define where they sit on that continuum. And this is how I think the struggle for religious liberty will actually help us move in the direction of greater liberal democracy and enhances the likelihood that liberal democracy will be sustained. And this is also where I was just at Provo, Utah with Cole Durham's outfit and his thing. This is where I got in trouble with somebody from the Harvard Divinity School. So if you're from Harvard, it might be a good time to leave. All right. Here's my argument. It's an argument that I made just recently out there in Provo. If you want religious liberty, you have to go all in for liberty in general. Okay? This includes equality before the rule of law, respect for private property rights, and the right to assemble and disassemble. And all of those things will be democratically enhancing. My big concern here is that you cannot compartmentalize religious liberty. There's a tendency, and I saw this amongst a number of people at that last conference and others, that we just want to talk about religion because religion is special. And that's our own little thing that we need to do. And so we're going to focus on religious liberty. But that can become extremely dangerous. And then being that we're at a Catholic institution here, I want to give you a Catholic example of this. Cardinal Francis George of Chicago, about 2 years ago, came out with a statement very concerned about the Health and Human Service mandate as part of the Affordable Care Act, the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. And I don't have that statement with me. I wish I brought it and wrote it down. It's on another computer that I have. But the gist of that argument was that the Catholic Church supported the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act in all its various components. And he also went on to say, and as we, as a Catholic Church, support a number of other regulatory mandates that deal with employment and health and safety and minimum wage, et cetera, et cetera. But, oh my gosh, this regulation on abortion fashions and contraception, how could you even think about doing that? He was shocked. Shocked! That he would say, regulate this, regulate this, regulate that, regulate this. And then all of a sudden, we're going to regulate something that you do too. Where'd that come from? Well, here's the lesson. When you hand over a lot of regulatory power to the state in other areas, don't be surprised when it comes back to bite you in the posterior. I almost said ass, and I don't think I can say that here. You'll notice I didn't. You're witness to that, right?
You didn't say it, okay. So it's...
The bigger the state is, the bigger the government is, the less liberty, the less religious liberty you have, and the less liberty in general you will have. And here are three reasons why. The first, the bigger the state, the more tax revenue it will need to carry out its state functions, ceteris paribus. They need to bring in more tax revenue. Oh, and guess what, churches and synagogues and mosques and other things here in the United States? You're tax exempt. That's a little bit problematic. Brings up a case that occurred, a half a decade, or maybe a decade ago or so now. Cole Durham would know better. It's one of the most important religious liberty cases that came around, and I don't think anybody's talked about yet. Kelo versus New London. You go, wait a minute, that's not a religious liberty case. What the case did was essentially expand the definition of when the government can invoke eminent domain seizures to take private property. And it expanded it not only to physical things like roads and sewage treatment plants, etc., but to tax revenue. If you could find more tax revenue of a certain activity, even if it's a private entity that you give it to, well, you go, by all means, take that property and give it to that group because tax revenue then can be used for all these other things. And you say, well, how does this relate to religious liberty? Well, let me tell you this. There was a court case in Cypress, California, Cottonwood Christian Assembly versus the City of Cypress, which was essentially the Kelo versus New London case on its way up to the Supreme Court until it was settled out of court. It was the same thing. The City of Cypress says after Cottonwood had tried to save its nickels and dimes and pennies to buy up a parcel of land and break ground there, the city came in and said, no, we want that. We want to give it to somebody else. We want to give it to a big box retailer. because, well, at first they said because that would create less congestion. Oh, yeah, never a traffic problem at Costco. But it really was about revenue. The Cottonwood wasn't going to generate enough property tax revenue, enough sales tax revenue. And so that's important. Now, I know some of you are saying, oh, but wait a minute, Professor Gill, it's okay because we got the Religious Land Use and Institutional Persons Act. It's okay. Good luck with that one. And we're going to see, I think, some collisions between RLUIPA and the Kelo versus New London decision in the future. But it's a warning, because if the churches are tax-exempt and the state needs more taxes, well, I'll let you put together those two things. The second thing is that a larger state creates its own bureaucratic interests that will crowd out and compete with the things that churches do. Now, in between starting wars and suppressing the population, churches actually do some pretty cool things. They provide social welfare services. They provide counseling. They build trust. They do all these wonderful things that really grow the economy. In fact, one of my colleagues at the University of Washington, Jim Wellman, calls this invisible charity because it never shows up in our national accounting of GDP. But it's really important stuff. But bureaucratic interests, once they start doing these things, bureaucratic institutions like to grow, like to expand their mission, expand their budgets and such, and they're going to look at churches and say, maybe we don't need you doing that kind of stuff. And there's been a lot of work by folks like Dan Hungerman and Notre Dame that actually show that there's some crowding out effect here. And I have to mention just briefly, too, I was very troubled by Ross Douthat Heitkamp, Ross's comments earlier on today. He had said something to the effect that if Catholic Charities loses its government funding, they're in a lot of trouble. And I was concerned about that. I say if Catholic Charities loses its government funding, I bet they can do some pretty cool and amazing things, because I trust the people who run that organization to do some pretty cool and amazing things. So the crowding out factor is always an issue. And in times that there's budget crises, maybe Catholic Charities won't get as much of the budget before. The last thing is that a larger state creates more opportunities for interest groups to lobby for subsidies and exemptions, and for politicians and bureaucratic leaders to use that leverage to get more, to gain more power over these groups. Okay? In economic terms, I'm a political economist, we call this rent seeking. Okay? You create a law and then you grant some exemptions from that. Right? Or you bring in a lot of revenue and you then dole these out in terms of subsidies. And you can make people dance. Who wants this thing? And politicians can often decide whether this bag of money or this specific exemption to this rule goes to this group or that group on a whim. And that, my good friends, is a violation of equality before the rule of law. It's turning over a lot of what we consider to be important functions of government to the whims of politicians and others. So I'm very concerned about a larger state being allowed to rent seek. And so to conclude here, I want to say that the Catholic Church and other religious groups are really at a critical juncture here in the United States, and by extension in the world at large. Because when it comes to promoting religious freedom in the world, I'm the first one to argue that the best way to do it is to set a good example here at home. And so for us religious groups who are concerned about religious freedom, we're at a very critical juncture here, right? And we get a choice. Here's our choice. Do you want to play the rent-seeking game and grant the existence of an ever-increasing state with the hope that religion is a special case, a special category, and will be granted exemptions? Or on the other hand, do you want to join the struggle for liberty in general, for private property rights, for respect for the rule of law, and for all those other freedom of assembly, etc., all those other important things? Do you want to join that struggle for everybody, for all religious freedom? And for Catholics here, you have a word for this. It's called subsidiarity. Love that concept. Might be a great time to dust that one off and revisit it, because I think it's a very important way for us to recapture not only religious freedom, but freedom in general. And from my vantage point, this project that we're engaging in, the Religious Freedom Project, is really the Freedom Project. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Tony. Well, I want to create a bit of a hopefully disagreement, actually, because you all, in fact, agreed about so much. So I want to try to identify some, perhaps, lines of disagreement amongst the four of you and then open it up to the audience. We just heard Tony very eloquently make the case that religious freedom really has to be seen as part of an integrated bundle of freedoms. And you were, I think, suggesting that as well, Nuket. So, in a sense, Tony and Nuket, you were making that case. And if I misinterpreted you, Nuket, please say so. But in a sense, you were saying, I took you to be saying that in Turkey, these things really stand and fall as part of a bundle of freedoms. The government in Turkey now might try to carve out religious freedom or tolerance for certain groups, but really it's part of a larger package of authoritarianism, in fact. Whereas Ani and Dan were making the case that actually religious freedom is special, and that religious freedom can be the thin end of the wedge of robust democratization, that carving out some freedom, maybe just de facto, but carving it out one way or the other can actually lead to an expansion of freedom and democratization. And these are different. These are quite different positions, the thin end of the wedge position and the bundled freedoms position. Would you care to comment on that, Dan?
So now I'm supposed to go against that.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Assert your independence. Come on. Yeah, Dan, do you want to start? Do you want to make the case for religious freedom being a special strategic, as it were, beachhead for expanding democracy?
Well, I don't know how much I would take the bait. I think there are deep relationships between religious freedom and other freedoms. And religious freedom itself involves the freedom of assembly, the freedom to participate, the freedom of speech.
As Ani was saying as well.
Yeah, it's hard to disentangle those things. And oftentimes when religious actors demand freedom for themselves, they're really demanding this whole package of things. But sometimes, I think, excuse me, say under an authoritarian regime, it might be that religious freedom is sort of the only kind of island of opposition. I think this was true under Suharto's Indonesia, that he repressed almost all sectors of society except, you know, these religious organizations were too powerful, and so he kind of grudgingly let them, you know, let them be, or let, you know, to some extent,
right,
do their thing.
Right.
But then, I think the same thing was largely true in Catholic Poland, where during communism, whereas the Catholic Church was, the government always wanted to suppress it, but it was just too big. It couldn't just kind of, baldly suppress it, or didn't want to.
So perhaps it was also during South Korea under the military dictatorship. The military there, up till 87, repressed every group, labor unions, etc., but not the church, and the church was an island that from which progress was made.
Island is a good metaphor. George Weigel called it moral extraterritoriality. It's almost like it has this little space of freedom, and then from that, if it decides that it then wants to mount opposition, that can be a very effective way to do that, and then, yes, can be a kind of leading wedge that can then bring other societal actors, into the same play and expand it, so it's not just religious freedom, but it's liberal democracy writ large.
All right, now, I felt, in a way, Ani, you were making an even stronger case because you made an explicit argument that when we're thinking about sequencing democratization, elections shouldn't come first. Actually, religious freedom should come first. You made that case very clearly. Could you expand on that, and why is that so important? Say, In a country like Egypt, for example, where in a way we've seen now a transition from a government that was run by Democrats who were not liberals, now we have a government run by liberals who are not Democrats. Might a sequencing that took religious freedom more seriously have helped there?
I think Egypt is a great case to illustrate that point. So if you think about kind of the treatment of the Muslim Brotherhood under Mubarak, you had a group that was suppressed, was not able to kind of develop its political expertise, to kind of develop, you know, was kind of confined to being a social organization that provided charity work and those kinds of things, but was not allowed to express itself formally politically, even though they did have independent people represented in the legislature, but so then, so you take you kind of take away that freedom from these groups, and then all of a sudden you have a revolution, and they find themselves in power. They have, you know, all of this support from society, wants to give them political power, yet they haven't had the chance to develop any sort of experience governing, and also think, okay, well, now it's our time to get payback. And so you kind of create this cycle where you have groups that are, and I think Dan brought this up earlier as well, where you repress religion, you create kind of more, you know, you take maybe conservative groups, push them towards more extremism, and then now Muslim Brotherhood is pushed out, being banned again. How are we not to expect greater extremism among that group as well? So so the argument about granting religious freedom first is really about allowing these groups to develop their kind of, you know, we talk
which
about
mean, which means all groups. I mean, in a way, the Muslim Brotherhood had an unfair advantage because they developed a massive civil society organization over the course of 80 years. Mm-hmm. Other groups had not had the same opportunity.
Right, but they weren't allowed to express them politically.
Right.
And that's
right.
The point is, if you allow them to kind of exist in this one sphere, but not kind of develop those skills in this other sphere, you know, then when they do find themselves in power, they don't know what to do. And so that's basically the point that I was trying to make about the sequencing.
So what's wrong with that picture, Tony?
Nothing. I actually...
Or maybe there's nothing wrong. Maybe there's more agreement here.
There's more agreement than you think there is, in part because... Yeah, and I agree fully with Dan, and actually I want to elaborate on his point. I think he made a very good point, and I think it also emphasizes the fact that folks who are in religious communities, we need to be on that cutting edge of the wedge. But that wedge, where religious liberty may come first, also needs the heft of everything behind that wedge. Otherwise, it's not powerful. When you think of an axe, right, you have the sharp leading edge there, and it wedges out. There's something heavy behind that that is going to force that. And Dan's very correct in that religious groups have played a very important role in some very authoritarian regimes because governments are afraid of religious organizations because they're incredibly good at organizing people. And this has been historically true, and they often lead the way in very, very useful moments. The abolitionist movement, getting rid of the international slave trade, that was religious groups. Another interesting, surprising one is the women's suffrage here in the United States. Evangelicals were an important component of that. And I know some of you are going, no way, not those evangelicals. And you know why they were? Because they wanted women to get the vote so that they could vote away the booze from the men. It wasn't so good. But nonetheless, okay, religious groups are incredibly important. To some extent, we have that ability to shelter us, and so we can, the things that we need or that religious groups need to promote their own religious freedom are the things that everybody else needs, and for them to actually be effective in that, the ability to organize, the ability to speak out, the ability to have property rights so you can have some place where you can meet and organize are very important. And so it's this idea of, well, it's either a bundle of a package at once or a wedge. I don't know. Maybe it's a bundled package with a sharp leading wedgy edge.
Okay. So. Nuket, no, wait, yeah, you can take any position you want. So I don't want to put you in a box.
No, I mean, I think we agree on the main points because, I mean, de facto, religious freedoms can exist in not-so-democratic countries, and religious freedoms can exist only for certain religions. Because, again, in the example of Turkey, if you look at what kind of rights Alevis have, it is much less than what kind of rights Armenians or Greek Orthodox have right now. So is it like, can we say now that there was progress in religious freedoms? Not for Alevis. I mean, my father is Alevi, and, well, we haven't seen anything, really. And when it comes to Egypt and the situation in Syria, Egypt, and other countries, we are obsessed, and I think this is very Western-centric, we are obsessed with legislation. We are obsessed with, let's create some religious freedom. How do you create religious freedom and inculcate it? Okay, you Egyptians right now, you take Copts like seriously as your fellow citizens. My cheesy argument is, instead of providing military aid to certain countries, invest in education, invest in civil society initiatives that will bring these populations together to work towards a common functional goal. So, everybody says that, yes, it's not something new. But we participated in creation, we as the United States, participated in creation of these problems. We provided Egypt with lots of money, lots of military capabilities. American policymakers were calling Assad dear friend 2 years ago. So we need to question all these things, and creating religious freedoms is more than legislation. It is really getting involved in societal dynamics, and that's why I think we should take it a bit more seriously than we usually do in academic world or in the policy world. That's my humble opinion.
Can I jump in on one point here? You mentioned something, a little phrase there, that in some countries you have religious freedom for some groups but not for others. That's not religious freedom. What that is it's a blanket start to say, well, we're not going to have any religious freedom, but this group gets an exemption from that, and they can have buildings, or we'll subsidize them this, that, and that way. For me, that's not religious freedom in a society. In fact, you know, people talked earlier or asked the question earlier about religious freedom from religion. And you know what? Religious freedom is very important for atheists, too, because it gives them the space to organize, and it gives them the ability to opt out of a group. So that's for everybody. So to say that there's religious freedom for some but not others is really not saying that there's religious freedom.
So there's no religious freedom in any country of the world, I guess, then.
It's always for
some people.
If you look at it as an endpoint, no. And so what I say, that there's a continuum, right? Because somebody's going to try to trap me by saying, well, you know, do you have religious freedom here or not? I say you have a levels of it. And you set up an ideal point, and you're moving toward. I know you never get toward the perfect ideal point, but let's move in that direction. That's where I'm at.
And this is why, when we study religious freedom empirically, we don't measure religious freedom. We measure the amount of restrictions there are on religion, right? Because religious freedom is this kind of abstract concept, and it's kind of hard to talk about. Okay, this absolute religious freedom, but there are levels of it, and there is a continuum of it.
Well, this has been fantastic. Let's broaden the conversation to include you all. Please raise your hand. I see my colleague A.J. Nolte in the back there would like to ask a question. A.J., by the way, is working on his dissertation on relationship between religious freedom and social stability and democracy. So A.J. is well qualified to ask a question.
Thanks very much, Tim. I was actually going to ask a slightly different question to maybe create some of the controversy that we didn't have in the panel. And my question is for Professor Gill. You mentioned sort of contra the idea that religion is special. Might a counterargument to that be that religion is a necessary precondition for creating the other liberties, in the sense that it does two things? One, it creates a transcendent authority to which the state can never overtake. And two, in a very practical sense, it creates a practical locus of authority independent from the state, which perhaps some of those other freedoms don't. So how would you respond to that argument that perhaps maybe religion really is more special?
By focusing on a word that you used, you said that religion is a necessary component for creating freedoms based upon some transcendent anchor point that we could actually have. In many ways, I'm somewhat sympathetic to that, but I would just change the wording a little bit. I say is a very important component, not necessarily a necessary one, but a very important one, because, again, I want to extend these benefits to my non-believing brethren and bring them on board on this issue. I think if we, my fear is, and I've seen people argue this before, if we say religion is something so very special, which I think, you know, and by the way, don't get me wrong, that I'm not trying to demean religion, because I it's very important to me. But if we put it into a special category against everything else, then it's easy for people who are not religious to argue against us. Oh, we don't need that and stuff. But religion is very important. We are the tip of the spear, the part of the wedge, but we need everybody else on board. And so I'm afraid of us compartmentalizing to say we're so necessary, we're so different, we're so special that we don't care what happens to the rest of the liberties out there as long as we have ours. That's what I'm concerned about.
Mm-hmm. Tom, did you have a question? Yeah, great. Tom Farr?
Just to pile on Tony a little bit on that issue.
He can take it.
If I could just restate something that AJ was getting at. Nothing limits the state like religion.
Yeah.
You want a limited state? Atheists, maybe they want a limited state. Atheism doesn't limit it, but religion does by positing the transcendent authority that AJ was talking about. And I would add to that, nothing energizes civil society like religion. Bowling alone laments the decline of civil society, but notes that in America, at least, civil society is energized by the various religious groups. So quite apart from the rightness or wrongness of a particular religion, to the extent that they do play the democratic game, as it were, and posit a transcendent authority, then your desire to root everything in liberty, it seems to me, is carried out more effectively. So that's just another way of saying what I think AJ was getting at.
And I'd like not only you to answer, Tony, but could you pick up on that as well, Ani? Because I think that connects with some of what you've been writing about with respect to the important role religion plays in building up an associational life in a lot of these societies. But Tony first.
Just again to reemphasize the point, and I'm on board with you. And you know, I have a lot of friends who are natural right folks, and I think I'm one of them too, but I can't ever understand what they say. I might just part ways with a bit is that that term necessary. I don't think it's necessary. I think it's very, very important. Maybe I'll add three more varies. Very, 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 very important. And why I think as religious communities, we have to be ever vigilant in terms of those. So instead of necessary, I just say very, 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 very important.
Okay. Ani, could I have you comment as well? To Tom's question, I mean, is religion necessary? Is it very, 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 very important? And if it's, well, either way, why?
Yeah. Right. Yes. At the same time, I also agree that this kind of... I'm afraid I'm going to put myself in this box. And I believe that religion is very, very, very necessary. And I think that in societies where religion is... where you have high levels of religiosity, where you have high levels of religious participation, it is very necessary in terms of limiting the state, questioning the state, keeping the state in line, keeping the leaders in line, keeping them in check. I don't think that's true for every society, though. And so I think we need to kind of take into account that we're dealing in different contexts and to kind of impose that one version of the necessity of religion on every society doesn't necessarily work everywhere. But I think it's also important to think about, you know, there are, you know, in very, very religious societies, non-religious people suffer quite a bit. And so, okay, maybe religion is very free, contributing to kind of... you know, calling into, you know, keeping the government in line, not allowing them to, you know, suppress certain kinds of rights. But in those kinds of societies, if the non-religious people are not given the same types of rights, you don't have, it's not a free society. It's not a democratic society.
Yeah, Dan, go ahead.
I want to add one other thing to that. I mean, my view is maybe religion isn't necessary, but I see religion as natural or something that is... you know, kind of inherent to who the human being is, that in an extraordinarily wide variety of cultures across time and place, humans have, you know, spoken to or practiced religion. But I think in that kind of natural phenomenon are certain things that I think are great assets for liberal democracy. One is almost all religion posits a kind of encompassing, unseen, transcendent order, of which the state is only a part, and of which the state is somehow accountable to, or part of the, you know, should be kind of oriented towards that order. Well, if that's true, then the state always has some kind of limitations to it. And it's in the 20th century when you started having the past. I mean, if you look at the great totalitarian governments of the 20th century, all of them were fundamentally atheist or anthropocentric, humanity projecting a kind of order that comes just out of humanity. I mean, communism, Nazism, and so forth. And so in a sense, when you can see when that transcendent realm is taken away, then totalitarianism, which is totality, then moves into the vacuum and becomes a possibility. I would say the other thing is that following my favorite philosopher, Thomas Aquinas, religion is a natural virtue, and the political is also natural. He thought the government or the political order was natural. Well, not only the two are natural, but the two are different. Mm-hmm. So you have different forms of activity and different forms of community that each have their own kind of internal telos or logic. Well, if you think that both of that is true and they're both important, then they need to be kept separate, or at least, there have been many combinations of how they're intertwined over time. Mm-hmm. But, virtually every religion has some sort of separation between the clerical caste and the... Yeah. Even some of the most intertwined societies, like Iran or medieval Catholicism, even they still had some conception. These are the clerics, and these are the political people. So you get inherent, you get divided authority. And
I want to, if I may, I'd like to have us group a couple of questions. I would like to have John Carr in the back ask a question, head of a new institute here at Georgetown. Great to see you, John, and then Ian Linden as well, and then we'll get to Galen Carey.
Well, first of all, congratulations on a great day and a half. One comment and one question. One, in defense of Cardinal George, I'm not an expert on religious liberty, but I know something about the U.S. Catholic bishops and healthcare. And I think what Cardinal George probably said, since we don't have the text in front of us, is the bishops were longtime supporters of universal healthcare, and that they wanted to go about it in a way that ensured respect for religious freedom and conscience. But because I'm not an expert, is democracy, which is the theme of this panel, in some ways an adversary of religious liberty, or at least religious minorities? And I point to three experiences: Iraq, Egypt, and now Syria, where Christian communities or Catholic communities now look upon the days of the dictator as the good old days and are quite fearful of the democratic impulses or revolutions that have arisen. Is there something about minorities, religious minorities, how do they come to depend on dictators for their own safety and security?
Great. Fantastic question. Let's hear from Ian Linden quickly as well, and then we'll respond.
With the development and growth of religious freedom units in State Department, in Canadian government, and as British unit as well, we're obviously at a very important turning point in diplomacy, and with the German government pointing to the importance of that in the work of all their embassies and so on. One of the problems, I think, is that as a result of the very heavy politicization of human rights during the Cold War period, the sort of quote-unquote non-aligned movement countries, if one can still talk about that, are very suspicious and, one might say, almost paranoid about the intentions of these countries in the promotion of religious freedom. There is, in a sense, there's a sense in which, we're on the back foot rather, and we have to sort of prove ourselves. So, I mean, my own thought is that it's absolutely essential that it's demonstrably the case that there is not a politicization of religious freedom as a right. That, for example, Canada, United States, Britain is as much concerned, if not more concerned, at the persecution of the Rohingya in Myanmar, of Muslims in Gujarat, and so on, as a particular step. And I wondered whether you had any thoughts of any other ways in which we could, as it were, make people convinced that what you see is what you get, a genuine, and what I believe to be the case, highly committed people who deeply believe in this project, rather than, in fact, instrumentalizing rights for political reasons.
Thank you. Two excellent questions. Let's take John Carr's very powerful, very urgent question about Christians in places like Syria and Egypt. Are they not right to yearn for the days of authoritarianism? What do we say to them about democracy? Anyone who'd like to respond?
I can start with that because I conducted some interviews with Syrians, and Copts in Egypt. And I, a couple of years ago, before these things came to this extent, I asked a question and said, well, you suffered from a lot in the past, and obviously this is not the ideal type of governance. So why don't you just go out and protest as people who already have been through a lot in the past? And these individuals, different individuals, gave the same answer, saying that this, since we suffered in the past a lot, we changed places. Like the Assyrians in Syria actually was coming from Ottoman, like Turkish, they were coming from Anatolia, escaping the Young Turks. So they said, well, we are really fine right now, and I guess it's others' turn to defend something. I mean, we can go to our churches, we can go to school, there is no problem we are having. So I think it is unfair to expect them to sacrifice themselves after being through so much in the past. So I was very judgmental, frankly, a couple of years ago. I'm like, well, you have a duty. But I guess they don't. I mean, they are not actively supporting dictators right now. Their argument, as you can see in English outlets as well, what is the alternative? So what kind of alternatives do you give us so that we will stop supporting Assad and we will start supporting someone but not Free Syrian Army, or which started to include Salafi elements? So it is for them, it's a matter of life and death, and they have been through that. So it is understandable that they will support whoever they are comfortable under, given the traumas they had. And I think, I mean, my personal decision in the end was to think twice before making any judgments about why Copts supported like some autocratic arrangements or why Assyrians in Syria sided with Assad. So I don't know, that's my personal
Do you have
judgment.
Thoughts, Ani, on that
well,
issue?
I think the two questions are interestingly related, because if we look at if we think about what we can do in terms of U.S. or Canadian or British foreign policy and not be seen as kind of advocating for particular groups but advocating for religious freedom in general, is we can be more careful about not kind of only focusing on religious minorities and being more aware of the fact that the majority has minorities within it and minority factions within it, and be really careful about identifying groups that are in danger, no matter whether they are in the majority technically or in the minority.
Well, and you pointed out the cases in Central Asia where most of these governments are repressing the majority religion in the name of suppressing extremism.
Exactly.
Dan, do you have a comment as well?
I was just saying, if one looks at it purely in terms of incentive structures, it's hard to see why, you know, majority would respect a minority that it doesn't like very much. I think you have to look at political theology and culture, too. And look at, say, 19th century America, where you know, many Protestants had deep suspicions about the effects of Catholics on the country, allegiance to a foreign power. They thought that Catholics had a theology that didn't respect the American Constitution and so forth. But I think it was only their kind of overriding intense belief among widely shared among Protestants in religious freedom, as embodied in the First Amendment, as embodied in many of their theological commitments, that they, you know, nevertheless still allowed that religious freedom in a strong de facto way.
Please.
Just very quick points. A few things I didn't get to say, some of these that I'd wanted to. But first, when it comes to Syria, I mean, the choice there is between authoritarianism with religious toleration for me as a religious minority versus authoritarianism with religious repression. Okay, so that is it not, I mean, it's not, this change is not going to lead to greater democracy or anything like that. It's two crappy choices, as we talked about, what the, you know, State Department oftentimes has to deal with. The other thing, too, that I want to mention, and Brian Grimm earlier on showed us the relationship between religious liberty and a lot of good outcomes and how it can subvert a lot of conflict and things. But I want to point out that in a dynamic sense, and we shouldn't kid ourselves about this, when you introduce more religious liberty in a society, whenever you change some kind of institutional arrangement, There are going to be winners and there are going to be losers. And the losers are somehow or are likely to fight back. And so do not be surprised if there is informal instances of religious persecution and religious conflict when you're implementing religious liberty. Let's, you know, be sure that we're very clear so we know what we're getting into. It's not all magic unicorns and strawberry-scented butterflies. The last thing, and also to clear up maybe for what AJ and Tom says, I was writing this down as I talk, and let's see if you guys can get on board with this. I said, because we as religious communities and individuals have a conception of the transcendent, we are in a unique position to fight for freedom. And because I love God's creation so much, I want to share that with my non-believing brethren and other people who may disagree with me.
All right. Galen, Carrie? And do we have another question as well? Did you have a question as well?
Yes.
Okay, great. So we'll take two questions.
Galen Carey with the National Association of Evangelicals. A similar question about is the idea of religious freedom for some, does that betray a static notion of religious identity, like something you're born with and it's just, you know, so if you're either in the favor group or the non-favor group. But doesn't, in fact, if there's unequal treatment of different religions, is that not detrimental to all groups? Because when the government puts its thumb on the scale, even the favored group is being hurt because then you're introducing other motivations, not is this religion true, but will I get more benefits if I join or stick with this religion? And so then it has a corrupting, does it have a corrupting influence on all religions and thereby reduce their religious freedom?
That's a great question, Galen. And Brian Grimm earlier today said that the form of religious restriction that's most highly correlated with social violence and religious violence around the world is, in fact, government favoritism of religion, which actually then, interestingly, imposes actually many more costs on societies, including the majority religion, than we might realize. Yes? And please identify yourself as well.
Sure. My name is Ryan Hunter. I'm with the Institute on Religion and Democracy. So this is directed mainly at Professor Nuketz from what you said earlier, but if any of you would also like to respond as well. You talked about your interviews with many different religious minorities in Turkey, from Armenian or Apostolic Orthodox to Greek Orthodox to different Muslim minorities and Alawis. In your findings, did you come across a sense of deep suspicion of other religious minorities? Because I have a lot of friends in Syria and in Egypt who are religious minorities, and they have this kind of, because of the situation, they have this kind of fortress mentality of suspicion, where the attitude is, like someone addressed earlier, rather than hoping for things to get better, people simply are hoping things don't get worse. And so rather than in a sort of cross confessional or cross or interreligious solidarity among minorities, there is rather fear between the different sects, which contributes to a further breakdown of social order and preventing any real meaningful dialogue, much less peaceful resolution in the wake of horrific civil and political breakdown.
Great.
Thanks.
So why don't we start with that question for you, Nuketz, sure. And then we'll turn to Galen Carey's question as well.
My findings from my research and also my personal observations point to the fact that you suspect the members of your own community more than you suspect the members of another tradition. So I would be more suspicious of some other fellow Muslims who are engaged in different political activities than I would be suspicious of Jews or Christians. So the short answer is yes, and as I said, none of these ancient churches, like the Greek Orthodox, Armenian churches, or the Assyrian, they were very suspicious of Protestant missionary activities. Greek population has the fewest members, 3,000. So Armenian population thinks that if we are associated with the Greeks, they are disappearing anyway, so we don't want to be there. They will just go. So Greeks and Jews are thinking that Armenian civil societies are too active right now and they will get whatever they want, but they are the ones who are actually suppressed more. And everybody is suspicious of the Jewish community. So it is that's another aspect of it. And within the Jewish community, when you talk to different members, and we were talking about this in the morning, there is also a reactive, more democratic Jewish community under the rabbinate in Istanbul, going against the decisions, central decisions of the rabbinate, saying that, well, you should consult your community instead of taking some decisions in your under, behind your closed doors. So you see all these types of suspicions, yes, and you see all types of within tradition arguments and tensions.
The Erdogan regime is citing the establishment of secular representatives or representatives of these minority groups directly to the prime minister's office. I've heard, of course, of Patriarch Bartholomew's meetings with the prime minister and so on, but is it a very top-down, centralized structure where the representatives in Ankara do not necessarily have to confer with local congregations, or is it somewhat representative or accountable?
It's a step forward. I mean, nobody right now expects the Turkish government to start consulting with civil society. So the fact that there is one person, like secular representative, and a very popular person, everybody loves him, like Kivingas. So I haven't heard anything negative about him from any community. He's very active. So the fact that right now there is one secular representative who can actually, he was very dedicated and who is in touch with all the communities, is a step forward for these communities. Is it ideal? It's far from ideal, but it is better than what we had in the past.
Anyone like to respond to Galen Carey's question? Yeah, Ani?
I think this, I mean, we haven't really talked about this issue about state favoritism of groups, but I think it's really important because, and Tony develops this theoretically well, but, you know, if you think about kind of state favoritism of religious groups and setting up restrictions that, you know, or regulations that favor one group and then restrict against others, again, we get into this issue of, okay, well, when the regime changes, those things are going to change as well. So it's very kind of tricky and risky for groups to get into these situations. And the case that comes to mind just off the top of my head is Russia here, where you've got, you know, initially you've got, you know, religion repressed severely under the Soviet Union, under Gorbachev, expansion of religious freedom, several years later, with lobbying from the Russian Orthodox Church, restriction of religion. We're seeing, you know, for a while, Putin didn't seem that close to the church, to the Russian Orthodox Church. Now he seems to be getting closer and closer. But, you know, that can change depending on what Putin feels like doing that day, right? or whether it helps him to have the Russian Orthodox Church behind him or not. So it's a risky strategy on the part of churches to go after that kind of favoritism from the state as well. So I don't know if the question was specifically about kind of strategies, but it is interesting to think about it in terms of strategic priorities of both the regime and the groups. But maybe Tony wants to add anything.
I wasn't going to, but now that you prompted me.
Sorry.
The unequal treatment of religious groups. If you notice when I talked, I emphasized individual liberties, and I think individual liberties are very important here. I'm very concerned about giving a favoritism to one group over another group because that it tends to force people into the group. It tends to conform them to a certain group, which is why I really like individual liberties. And I think a basis for a lot of religious liberty, and it expands from everything else, are anti-apostasy laws. You're getting rid of anti-apostasy laws, I should say, because apostasy actually, and this is going to sound weird, apostasy can be very good for a religious group in that as people leave the group, it tells the leaders of that particular denomination, maybe you're not doing a very good job, and maybe you have to work a little bit harder. And so that in that respect, I really want to emphasize the individual rights of conscience above any specific favoritism for this group, that group, or whatever group.
Thanks very, very much. Well, let me just close not just this panel, but the last 2 days with some very brief remarks. I first want to express my thanks to all four of you, Dan Philpott, Nuket Sandal, Ani Sarkissian, and Tony Gill. You all were outstanding, so thank you all very much. And let me also say that this conversation and the conversation we have undertaken the last couple of days is going to continue. It'll continue first on the web. Those of you who want to re-listen to the conversation in any form will soon be able to access all the panels in video and audio form. So look for that on the RFP, Religious Freedom Project, website. Second, I want to say that we will soon be launching a blog on the issue of religious freedom, on all of the kinds of issues we've discussed in the last couple of days. Nicholas Walterstorff, John DiIulio, several others have already submitted gems of essays on various topics in religious freedom. So we'll soon be launching that. We'll soon be inviting you to be part of that conversation as well. We have a number of exciting events coming up soon, including a major conference on the contributions of Christianity to freedom, religious freedom and civil freedom, which will be in Rome, Italy, December 12th through 14th. You all are invited. So mark your calendar, join us in Rome if you can. Finally, let me say that this conference has been a capstone. That is, it has really brought to a very exciting conclusion our last 3 years of work on various dimensions of religious freedom. But it is also a cornerstone. This conference is laying the foundation for another 3 years of new work on religious freedom, and specifically on the impact of religious freedom on social flourishing, economic, political, and societal stability. And many of the scholars that you've heard on our panels will be part of that new three-year phase. So we are very excited. We're very grateful to all of you for being part of this conversation. Please stay tuned, and please continue to be involved in the Religious Freedom Project. And please join me in thanking the panel and all those others who've spoken the last 2 days. Thank you. And please take your gold stars as you leave. You all are honorary graduates of the RFP PhD in Religious Freedom.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.